relatively simple, hopefully. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about the thermodynamical conditions that we have around gamma ray burst sources, so that you get a little bit of a feeling of the type of microphysics that we care about. So I'll talk about accretion disk, and hopefully I will convince you that the microphysics of these disks are very interesting. So for those of you that don't know, and I'll stop, I just wanted to show this movie if you've never seen a gamma ray burst. So this is what a gamma ray burst looked like. This is counts as a function of time. Yeah, so as you can see, they're highly variable, and they emit the majority of their energy at MeV energies. Yeah.
So this is a gamma ray repeat,
right? And that is a gamma, yeah. They don't repeat in the sky, but this is shown just for your own amusement. And interestingly, as you know, this is the gamma ray sky, for those of you that haven't seen it, and it's, of course, dominated by the Milky Way, and particularly because of pi and decay interactions of cosmic rays with the high density interstellar gas in the plane of the Milky Way. And there are about thousands of sources at this time that we knew, but when a gamma ray burst is on, it basically overwhelms the luminosity of every single existing gamma ray source in the sky, actually including the sun. Yeah. So these objects are extremely, extremely bright. So the two things that I want to focus on, if you wanted to really explain what are the energetic requirements that you need, is one, that you need very high luminosity, and that the time variability is small. Okay. So I'll write down the... Like this one?
Yeah.
There you go. Okay, so the two important ingredients is that, at least for the discussion that I'm going to lead today, is that the gamma ray luminosity . So we know their distance, yeah, we know they're cosmological, and of course we measure a flux in the detector. So when we convert that to cosmological distance, the luminosities are extremely high, 10 to the minus 53. And of course we don't really know if these objects, well, we now know that they're beam, but in reality you multiply them by 4 pi, but it depends on whether or not these objects are beam. But from this discussion I will just basically use as an order of magnitude about 10 to the 50 ergs per second. Yeah? And that it's emitted in gamma rays. For those of you that don't know, and in astronomy we always use CGS, that this doesn't, whether or not this makes sense to you. For example, the sun puts about 10 to the 38 ergs per second. Yeah. So if you take, for example, how many stars there are in a galaxy? Well, there's about 10 to the 10. How many galaxies there are in the universe? There are about 10 to the 10. So if you multiply 10 to the 10, multiply by 10 to the 10, multiply by 10 to the 38, yeah? You get that a gamma ray burst puts as much energy in a second as all the stars in the universe put together. Yeah? So they're extremely, extremely energetic objects. The other important thing is, of course, that the radius of the emitting source just by light time crossing arguments have to be less than about 10 kilometers because we see variability in the orders of milliseconds. Yeah. Okay. So if you care about the metabolics of gamma ray bursts, you basically have to, explain how can you get these very high luminosities, and of course you have to require, a very compact object. So of course, accretion onto a compact object, as you know, particularly if that object is a neutron star of a gamma ray burst, give you, high efficiency in conversion between accretion of a gram of mass into radiation. So this is basically what...
How How does that number work out? So you said 10 to the 38 was the luminosity of the sun. So 10 to the 58 is the luminosity of the universe. So, is that,
I'm sorry?
So you said luminosity of the sun.
It's 10 to the 33 arcs per second.
10 to the 33, okay.
And then 10 to the 10, 10 to the 10. Yeah. 10 to the 38 is the Eddington limit. And this is what I will derive right now. Okay, so usually in astronomy, and this is something that, you know, when these objects were sort of discovered, you know, people talk about, do you know what the Eddington limit is? The majority of you? No. Okay, so okay, imagine that you supply a compact object with a certain mass, and I'll going to talk about everything radial inflow, spherically symmetric, and then I'll talk about what happens when you have angular momentum. Now, imagine that that source has some efficiency in giving you some radiation back from the amount of mass that you're accreting. Yeah. Yeah. So you produce some photons. Yeah. And what Eddington thought is, well, there must be a balance when the radiation pressure of the photons is comparable to the gravitational pressure. Yeah. So if you, you know, basically what Eddington did is says, well, what's the radiation pressure? And I equal that to the gravitational pressure, and that should give me a limit. Yeah. Because if I start feeding the engine more efficiently, you know, the radiation pressure will basically halt the mass that it's ultimately supplying it with the gravitational binding energy. So there's actually a very nice way to derive the Eddington limit. So I'll do it here. So you can say, well, if I have a surface area, a certain flux, yeah, that has to be equal to the force per unit area. So basically I balance, you know, on a closed surface, both the radiation pressure, where this is kappa, the opacity, yeah, and the gravitational energy. So this implies yeah, that the basically the force, yeah, on the particles, and usually, for example, I'm going to talk about Eddington thought about Thomson scattering. So if you have a bath of free electrons, that basically everything is ionized. Remember that the gravitational force is felt by the protons, but the radiation pressure is felt by the electrons. Yeah, and that was the. And then you use, of course, the potential. Then you can use Gauss theorem to go from your integral in area to volume, and that very simply gives you 4 pi g and the integral of your density over volume, which is the enclosed mass. Yeah. So the Eddington limit is basically 4 pi g c mass enclosed divided by kappa, which is your opacity. Yeah. So the way that, for example, you find this in the textbooks is that the flux goes as 1 over r squared, the gravitational force goes as 1 over r squared, so there's basically no radial distance, and there's basically a limiting luminosity at all radius in which these two forces are equal. Now, a lot of people say that the Eddington limit is only valid when you're spherically symmetric, but mathematically, in general, what matters is that you have a closed surface. What matters is the enclosed mass and the flux across that surface. And provided that the surface is closed, then you can derive the Eddington limit. Okay. So we're going to use this derivation for, and we'll re-derive the Eddington limit, but for neutrinos. Okay, so then you can derive the opacity in terms of the cross-section. And the Eddington limit
But we agree that you can come up with situations where you don't satisfy the inclination, right? I mean, then the geometry is too bizarre.
Yeah, so people think, like, for example, if you're creating an accretion disk and the mass goes in and your radiation goes upwards, you may be able to violate the Eddington limit, but when you do it in detail, it's really hard to violate it for more than a factor of a few. For example, what violates the Eddington limit? 9 feet solar flares in the sun. Why? Because you have basically the extra gravitational support is actually come by magnetic pressure if you have a loop. So the loop holds basically the photons, and then you can get a small hotspot, you know, emitting above the Eddington limit. Okay, so this is what it is, 10 to the 38 ergs per second for a solar mass of material. So the sun is 5 orders of magnitude below the Eddington limit. And in fact, the reason why the most massive stars, there's a limit at how much, you know, how large the most massive stars are, is because the luminosity of the star goes as m cubed, more or less. So of course there's arrived a point in which a star, you know, reaches its Eddington limit, which is about 200 solar masses, and then the star blows itself apart. And you know, the Eddington limit is one of the reasons why there's, you know, a limit of how massive a star can be. But the interesting thing that I want you to compare is just this luminosity to the required luminosity that we have for gamma ray bursts. Yeah? So we're about 12, if not 14 orders of magnitude above the Eddington limit for photons. And this actually, it's very nice because, for example, most of accreting objects in the universe that are a solar mass, neutron star, black hole, certainly do not go above this Eddington. And actually, massive black holes in the center of galaxies also obey that term. That is the Thomson cross section. So it's for electron scattering. Yeah. So you, for example, if you think about the Kleinschina corrections to the Thomson cross section, it goes as 1/n. Yeah. So that means that if you, in principle, had a source that is radiating most of its energy at higher gamma rays, yeah, then the cross, you know, you're allowed to radiate, you know, above the Eddington limit because the cross section decreases. No? There is an energy dependence when the energy of the photons gets comparable to mc squared, which is the rest mass of the electrons. So when the h nu goes above mc squared, yeah, then the photons, you know, they no longer see a constant cross section, and there's a 1/n term. That's what I was saying. Yeah. Okay. So then, you know, the whole point is that the Eddington photon limit in this case is circumvented by, so the transport of energy in these objects are not photons, but, you know, a weakly interactive particle, and that's neutrinos. So what I'm going to do is rewrite everything in terms of the Eddington rate for neutrinos. And I just decided when I was doing this to use the cross section for absorption of neutrino anti-neutrino annihilation in pair production. So most of what I'm going to derive, it's okay as an order of magnitude, but the energy scalings you can change depending on what's your favorite cross section interaction. If you wanted to do scattering of free nucleons, you can always do that. So then you can rewrite the Eddington limit in neutrinos, and you get something like 8 × 10^53. The cross-section depends on the energy of the neutrinos. Yeah? So this is the equivalent Eddington luminosity, but in neutrinos. So the only thing I'm basically stating here, it's when the neutrino pressure, yeah, becomes comparable to the gravitational pressure. And of course, since the cross-section is so much smaller, you know, this only happens when the neutrino flux is much, much higher. Now, in this case, of course, it depends on the neutrinos, because the higher the energy of the neutrinos, you know, the more coupled to the matter they are. Yeah? Okay, so then I'm going to try to derive basically all quantities in terms of this Eddington limit.
So
we
can ask
you
just to get a physical picture here. Uh-huh. Are you imagining a neutrino flux which goes outwards? Scatters on the electrons now, or do you have a neutrino-antineutrino annihilation which produces the electrons.
Yeah. So for example, what makes you think of? This is more or less. I mean, if you think about it, the neutrinos from 87A, which is the nearest core collapse supernova that we're seeing, it's about 10 to the 54 ergs per second in neutrino fluxes. Yeah. So of course you immediately know. Okay, the reason why supernova explode. Yeah. It's because as the core collapses, you generate all of these neutrinos. Yeah. The amount of flux of neutrinos that you generate is comparable to the binding energy of a neutron star, which is about of the order of about 10 to the 54 Earths per second. And you know that the kinetic energy of a supernova is only 10 to the 50 ergs. So that means that only less than 0.1% or a percent or so of the neutrinos couple to the matter and are able to overturn the flow. Yeah? Now, in this case, yeah, neutrino to neutrino annihilation is a little bit more complicated because it depends on the angular dependence. But the main cooling and absorption is in these environments is actually the electroweak interactions. So capture of protons and neutrons, capture of electron positron pairs into positrons and neutrons, and they also gives you the opacity. But also scattering off free nuclei, it's an important opacity. Yeah. So what you're thinking about is this object is basically thermalizing to temperatures of MeV, is radiating neutrinos very efficiently, and a fraction of those couple into the remnant. At the Eddington limit, basically the coupling is very efficient, and it doesn't allow more of the mass to accrete. Is that more or less what?
I think I didn't understand. So if you want to draw the analogy, the neutrino should be a scattering of something. And what is it here?
Yeah, I mean, here it's just opacity of, neutrino to neutrino annihilation through positron electron pairs.
Is it because neutrinos are some more abundant than electrons that it is the neutrino antineutrino annihilation which provides the radiation pressure rather than neutrino electrons scattering?
Yeah, I could have used the electron. Yeah, and then there's a non-negligible probability for them to annihilate above the remnant, and that gives you a win. If you do it inside the matter, you're absolutely right. That is basically a scattering off of neutrons that dominates. It depends on the density, no? And temperature. I just use that as just pick a cross section and their highest quantities, but you can do it for any. Okay.
So are these guys in thermal equilibrium inside the region you're talking about? The neutrinos or no?
Yeah, so for example, in supernova calculations, you see that the deviations from the equivalent black body component is about 2%.
Okay.
Okay, so I can basically, if I equate my Eddington limit to some radiation efficiency, and I just for simplicity, I'm going to assume that efficiency is 1, I can derive basically what's the equivalent mass efficient rate that I need to be radiating at the Eddington limit. So that gives me a mass efficient rate. Which is a fraction of the solar mass per second. And that's really what I wanted to get an intuition for, that these sources basically reprocess about a fraction of the solar mass per second in a region that is, of course, you know, smaller than a neutron star or about the size of a neutron star. So then I can, for example, also tell you what the time it takes an object to radiate away all of its rest mass energy. It's called the Eddington time scale. That is, of course, m over m dot, where m is, of course, the mass scale of the accreting object. So not surprising, you know, the time scale of basically energy depletion in these systems is of the order of seconds. Yeah? And the thing that I really want to point out is that the dynamical time scale of the source, and I'm going to assume here that it's a black hole, just because black holes give you a nice relation between radius and mass. It's very, very small. Yeah, so the dynamical time scale around these sources is milliseconds, and they're active for as long as seconds. Yeah. So for the, in the case of we're going to see in the accretion ray, the accretion, these phenomena, the viscous time scale, which will, as I will tell you what the viscous time scale is, the time scale that the source is active is much longer than its dynamical time scale. Okay. And of course, I can also tell you what the characteristic densities around these objects are. So these would be characteristic densities near the horizon. So the densities are, not surprising, rather high. Yeah? Nuclear density, say the core of a neutron star, is about 10 to the 14 grams per cc. And then you can ask, well, you know, what happens to the photons? So we can calculate the optical depth of the photons, which is just basically the number density, which is just this divided by np, the 1/3 divided by the size of the object. And this gives me 10 to the 16. So usually what we do here is photons are basically part of the equation of state. Yeah? They're just a pressure term. The diffusion timescale of photons in these systems is just infinite for problems. Yeah. So as we said, you know, for photons to be able to scale, it requires luminosities of about 10 to the 38, but here we're basically orders of magnitude above that. So photons constitute part of the fluid, and we can do the same with...
Sorry, I'm a bit confused. What is it that is happening there? It's number density, this is the distance between photons, multiplied by the size of the...
Hi, okay, good, that's what it is.
Oh, actually, yeah. Yeah, so...
And then there is no 1/3.
Sigma n. Okay, and then I can also derive a temperature, say if I assume that they're in black body, maybe. Surprising. So the temperatures of these systems are relatively high. And then you say, well, what's really the maximum temperature in thermodynamical equilibrium that I can require? Well, it's called the virial temperature. And here, the only thing that you do is basically you say KT equal dm over r. Yeah? So that the energy per baryon is equal to the thermal energy per baryon. And that gives you a maximum temperature in
thermodynamical equilibrium. And it's about 3 times 10 to the 12 Kelvin. And the only thing that you have to make sure in the system is, of course, we always have the least Eddington temperatures less than the thermal temperature of the virial temperature, which just, you know, which you get just assuming this gravity to thermal equilibrium. And then similarly, I can also derive a black body, a magnetic field strength in a given partition, which is characteristic of the fields that you expect in this object. Characteristic of magnet R fields.
Yeah.
So the highest Newton stars have fields in the system. Okay, so basically, and it's not surprising, it is clear that at these densities and temperatures, neutrinos are produced very copiously, because the densities are 10 to the 12 and MeV temperatures, and they provide the main cooling mechanism for the systems. And the key requirement for the engines is basically that in order to attain these luminosities, I need to provide a fraction of the solar mass per second supplied to a compact object. Okay, so let me just show you. These are the sort of engines that are being discussed that power gamma ray bursts. This is Luis's favorite events. So you have, and I'll basically give you some examples of the accretion disks that you form around this object. So neutron star mergers, of course, in this case, the equation of state, the resultant merger, after they become dynamically stable, is much larger than what the equation of state can support. You have tons of rotations, so that ultimately leads to a black hole surrounded by an accretion disk. And all of these sort of cataclysmic events, mergers and collapses of massive stars, produce basically, in general, a black hole with an accretion disk, and the supply, the mass supply into these objects is of the order of the solar mass. Yeah. So in this case, the neutrinos are the main cooling.
So can you have accretion and a neutrino star that does the same thing for you instead of like merger or neutrino star?
Yeah. So you can. The key, I think, in this case, since you require such high rates, is whether or not the neutron star that is, whether or not can sustain those rates before it collapses to a black hole. But yeah, in principle, in the collapse of a massive star, you can create a magnetar, a fast rotating magnetar. So let me give you, if you take this magnetic field and you ask, for example, what's the amount of energy that can be released via torque, say by a pointing flux dominated outflow, the electromagnetic supply is a order of 10 to the 49 for a field that is about 10 to the 15 gauss. A period, a rotating period of the neutron star is 10 to the minus 3 seconds. And a radius of the rotating object, which is the size of the neutron star. So the two competing mechanisms is either what we call a magnetar, because you require a very, very high magnetic field, a fastly rotating magnetar in which most of the energy is given by a pointing flux, or an accreting black hole. And those, in principle, are hard to distinguish if the only thing that you care is the ultimate energy supply. But yeah, you're right. Now, in this case, as Luis can tell you, the key here is to really amplify the field to get to 10 to the 50 gauss. Yeah? Because if you take, say, the field of a massive star and you collapse it and assume basically flux freezing, you get 10 to the 12 gauss, which is more or less what you see in pulsars But for magnetars, you really need to amplify. You need a dynamo process that will get you a magnetic field to this. Okay. Okay, eraser. Well, I can go to the right hand side. It's not too far ahead for everyone, or should I delete the bill? Okay, so everything that I have told you, the scalings that we derive, are, you know, were derived in the assumption that the flow supply has no angular momentum and the flow is radial.
Yeah.
And for astronomers, that's usually called the Bondi flow. So basically, you have no magnetic fields and no angular momentum. But of course, the flow patterns change very dramatically once you have angular momentum. And this quasi-spherical approximation breaks down. So the radius of circularization basically depends on the specific angular momentum per unit mass divided by Gm.
Yeah.
So well, this is the specific angular momentum. And for example, if you want to have sufficient angular momentum, specific angular momentum, to build a disk around a massive black hole, that's the specific angular momentum that you need. Yeah? So if you have a specific angular momentum in excess of this value, then you will start forming an accretion disk around a black hole. Yeah? Now, in these scenarios that people have discussed, in this case, you have tons of angular momentum. But in this case, it's not entirely clear, actually, that you have sufficient angular momentum to actually form a disk. And the reason for that is usually because of how angular momentum transfer takes place inside stars. Usually the cores of these stars that we see rotating very rapidly may not have that specific angular momentum. But anyway, so that allows you to form an accretion disk around a black hole, and usually there's basically two fundamental or a fundamental scale that people discuss when you form an accretion disk. So an accretion disk is basically supported by rotation, yeah? And H is basically the scale height of the accretion disk. How important basically pressure is in giving you any vertical support. So if the emission, the radiation process, the cooling mechanisms in this disk is very efficient, that means that the temperature of the accretion disk is much smaller than the gravitational binding energy per particle, and what it means that H is much, much smaller than R. Yeah? And in this situation, it's called a thin disk. Yeah? So in astronomy or in astrophysics, when you have a material with angular momentum that has the ability to lose all its internal energy very quickly because radiation is very efficient, then you tend to get these very, very thin disks. And of course, similarly, if it's unable to cool, in the other case, so this is basically efficient cooling. Yeah. And for inefficient cooling, basically, when one is unable to cool, H is of the order of R, and you get a thin disk. Yeah? What does it mean? In other words, that the sound speed, the vertical sound speed is comparable to the orbital speed. Those two are comparable, and that means the H over R are. Okay, so now let's try to use the quantities that we derive to think about what are the relevant sort of parameters of the flow. Okay, so something that I didn't mention that I maybe should is, of course, when you're trying to make these models and you want them to work out, you have to make the rates of these objects similar to the number of events that you see. So the number of gamma rays, which maybe to this audience doesn't tell you very, very much, is 1 to 10 per year per gigaparsec cube. Yeah? So for example, I can ask Luis, and of course, if they're very beam, if they're highly beam, if they're jetted, that means that for every one that you see, there's many that you don't see, and therefore you need to increase the rate. So this is about 10 to the 5 times less common than supernovae. Yeah? So they're very, very rare. Oh, sorry, I did give you the scales. Oh, so you compare them now. So this is how common in the universe supernova happen and type 1a supernova compared to the gamma ray bursts. So we're talking about a very exotic type of cataclysmic collapse, or a massive stellar collapse. And the problem is that the rates are very uncertain. And if you're into that, I can tell you why. But we can really this is one of the reasons why LIGO could have had detected gravitational waves if you take the optimistic rates, but if you take the non-optimistic rates, it's still consistent with that. But, so these systems, they do supply you with a fraction of solar mass per second, and they're common enough, at least within the error bars of our understanding of stellar evolution, which is still weak, give you the right number of events. Okay.
So good question. But if omega could be very small, so in principle they could be comparable, unless you know what omega is.
We know a little bit what omega is. So I can tell you there's actually a very nice geometrical beaming measure. So this gamma ray burst, the third quantity that you have to have there is that we see that the source is moving highly relativistic. Yeah? So you not only have to supply very, large amounts of energy, but that energy has to be carried by only a few bearings so that you attain very highly relativistic velocity. So the velocity that we measure is about gamma of 100. Yeah? So if you have a flow of gamma of 100 moving towards you, you only see the causally connected region, 1 over gamma, that's GP. And then I start moving through the external medium. Yeah? In the frame of the source, I see the interstellar medium moving relativistically towards me. So it actually takes a lot of energy to actually slow down one proton from the ISM. And then I start accelerating pretty quickly. And as I accelerate, my causally connected region starts growing.
It's
accelerating. So 1 over gamma grows. And then at some point, 1 over gamma reaches the size of the beaming of the jet, and then you're missing all this flux. Yeah? So here you're spherically symmetric, and then the spherical symmetry breaks. And then in the light curve, you see basically a very change in the steepening. And that change in the steepening has allowed us to measure this theta, more or less. Yeah? And this product is about 100. So that means that for every star that collapses and gives you a supernova, for every 10,000 stars or, give you a supernova, only one gives you a GRB.
Well, I would say more like 100. If that's 10,
yeah,
it's
like about
1,000.
No?
Yeah. 1,000.
Yeah, 100,000. And 1 BCs are actually, in fact, only a fraction of all the core collapse population. Type 2s are about 10 times more common. Okay.
What is AIC?
I'm sorry? Oh, neutron star accretion-induced collapse. So basically, if you supply a neutron star with significant amount of mass, say in a binary transfer, if you have a companion and it's supplying mass, and the neutron star goes above the limit in which the equation of state can support, which it's uncertain, it depends on the type of the equation of state, then you go into accretion-induced collapse. Okay, so generally, the relevant parameters of the accretion flow around these objects depend fundamentally on this dimensionless accretion ring, which I'm just saying, how close to the end to limiting neutrinos they accrete, and more importantly, more importantly, they depend very strongly on the ratio of, you know, how the inflow velocity compares to the free fall. So what do I mean there? If you have a pure radial flow, the inflow velocity is exactly the free fall. But if you have a, you know, supported disk, then the inflow velocity will be given by the viscosity. So I'll give you. So if you have, for example, an accretion disk. In order to supply mass into the compact object, you need the transfer angular momentum. Yeah? The way that you transfer angular momentum, you do that based on viscous stresses. Yeah? And we believe that most of this transfer angular momentum comes from turbulent viscous stresses that are actually generated by what we call the magnetorotational instability. But just, you know, the way that people usually parameterize this. So bulk kinematic viscosity, so the viscosity for a turbulent bulk kinematic viscosity in a turbulent flow depends on the size of the eddies and the overturn time scale of the eddies. And people usually parameterize this as alpha HCX. So what does that mean? Well, the overturn time of the eddies here, of the turbulent eddies, would require, by construction, to be smaller than h, which is the scale height of the accretion disk. So everyone's happy with that. And the turbulence has to be subsonic. So usually alpha has to be smaller or equal than 1. And this is what Shakura Sanayev did, and this is what it's, sometimes if you hear the alpha model, this is basically the alpha model for accretion disk. You basically put all your ignorance about the transfer of angular momentum into this alpha. So in this case, you get a nice relationship between basically the velocity of the inflow of gas divided by the free fall velocity, which for this discussion, the free fall velocity is of the order of the orbital velocity. Yeah? As an order of magnitude. It's basically alpha h divided by h over r squared. Yeah. What does this mean? If alpha is 1 and h over r is of order unity, then you have a purely radial flow. Yeah. You basically have no pressure support. Yeah. So you almost have just a Bondi flow. If you're cooling very efficiently, h over r can be very small. Yeah. And if alpha is very small, then the time scale that it takes viscously the disk to drain is very, very long compared to the free fall time scale. Yeah, because you have tons of pressure support. Okay, and then you can define, based on these quantities, the same densities that I told you before. So the density now in an accretion disk is this normalized M dot R over RG in radial coordinates. I'm deriving the
see the alpha that you're going to use is 0.01, and that's going to explain all these numbers.
The alpha that I'm going to use in the simulations is actually self-consistently obtained from generating the magnetic field, generating turbulent self-consistency, and getting. Now, the typical alpha that people get are about 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 2. There's a big debate in the community as to whether you're resolving all the cascade of the instability to the smallest scale. And so people don't really are comfortable quoting an effective alpha. Anyway, so this is just to give you a feeling that, of course, if this was of order unity, then what I'm just saying is that the density goes as r to the minus 3 halves, and this is just what you get from mass conservation, as the flow just goes radially inwards. But of course, if this is larger, that means that the densities, you know, tend to be lower, and that you can actually, in principle, deviate from this scaling, radial scaling, if you have any pressure support. And then the magnetic field also tends to decay as a function of radius. At least this is the equipartition magnetic field. And, of course, the temperature here has to be less than the virial temperature, which is just MPC squared divided by this ratio. Yeah. The only thing I'm saying is the binding energy in the last stable orbit is comparable to MC squared, and that just decreases with radius. Okay, so let me just give you a diagram of what this accretion disk do in general, and then I can show you some simulations.
When you said less stable orbit, you're thinking of a black hole?
Yes. So most of the scaling theory that I derived, I used the radius depending on mass scaling. So you can do the same of the scaling that I derived for a Huygens star, but then you have to keep the mass of the radius. But yes, so and another argument that I just said at the beginning, before you got here, was that based on the variability of the light curve, since it happens in millisecond time scales, you do require a source that is relatively small and compact. So people think stellar mass black holes. This is going to test my drawings. Yeah, so if you really care about what, so the flow parameter in these systems, is determined by this ratio. So what does this ratio mean? Well, it means that if your neutrino luminosity becomes comparable to the Eddington neutrino luminosity, then gravity and radiation pressure are comparable. And then if you really want to understand the evolution of this disk, in some cases you have to do full Boltzmann transport. The specific angular momentum of the matter that it supplies to the black hole, depending whether or not you get in a quasi-spherical flow or an accretion disk. And then the other important component is basically the cooling time divided by the dynamical time scale. Yeah? So that means that as a function of radius, you know, you have a wide range of time scales. And you have a profile of density and temperature, so you have a cooling function that may depend on multiple processes, which you have to put all of them self-consistently. Remember that when you do neutrinos, also the emission of neutrinos change the composition of the material, so you also have to follow the composition. If cooling is very efficient, then you have a thin disk. Yeah? But if cooling is not very efficient, then you have a lot of pressure support. I'll show you some simulations. When you put all these ingredients, how does it look? Yeah. I'll attempt to do the diagram a little. So when you do this, we have built these simple analytical neutrino cooled disk models, and I'll show you what type of solutions we get, just to give you a feeling of what are the physics around this. I have 1, 2, 3, 4 orders of magnitude here. 1, 2, 3.
You can project it on the.
I'm sorry?
You can project it on the screen if you want. I don't want to draw it.
You know, an astrophysicist that is allowed to use the board gets excited. I don't do this often enough. I'm enjoying it. Okay? So what I'm plotting here is the radial scale in terms of the Schwarzschild, some measure of the black hole radius, depending on what your favorite black hole is. And I'm plotting here the mass applied to the black hole in units of solar masses per second. Yeah? Okay, and for this particular model, I use a Schwarzschild black hole with three solar masses. And I'm going to use different colors. Okay, so
do you pick three solar masses because you're secretly thinking of a bi-neutral star system, or?
Yeah, I'm thinking of yeah. Yeah, so I'll show you. Yeah, so the simulation that I will show you is basically how the accretion disk evolution after the merger takes place.
Right, but if you have a black hole in the star system, you have the final black hole be 10, 15 solar masses.
That's right. I'd like things that are more common. Yeah, you can scale these, no, but I just wanted to get a feeling. Okay, so cool. Okay, so more or less what you see is the following diagram. Here is what I call the gravitationally unstable region. What does it mean? The accretion disk, yeah, is so massive, you're supplying it with rays that are very, very high, comparable to your own mass. Yeah? So the disk in some ways becomes gravitationally unstable. Yeah? And so basically, if you want to say it a different way, self-gravity of the disk starts to matter a lot. When the mass of the disk compared to the mass of the black hole is very small, then self-gravity of the disk doesn't matter. But here it does, and in fact, what we see is actually that the gravitational instability, sort of the typical n equal 1 mode, the spiral wave mode actually helps you to drive angular momentum inwards. Yeah? Here is where the neutrinos are trapped. That means that you're getting in which, basically, in a dynamical time scale, the neutrinos, in a viscous time scale, the neutrinos are trapped and don't leak. That means that the diffusion time scale is faster than the way that you bring them. Yeah? So you need very, very high accretion rates. And in the disk, they're only trapped very close to the last stable orbit. While, since most of the mass of the accretion disk is here, this is where it becomes gravitationally unstable. Okay. Then this line here, more or less, is when cooling via neutrinos becomes efficient, and at these densities and temperatures, it's mainly the electroweak interactions that give you most of the cooling. Yeah? And here is when the neutrinos start to be inopaque. So you can basically, in your mind, choose an accretion disk, which in some ways gives you a mass of the disk, and this basically tells you where in the diagram you evolve. Now, if you start with an accretion disk that it's, you know, a fraction of the solar mass, it depletes. So basically, you're moving in this direction as a function.
So you're talking about a thin disk or efficient cooling or inefficient?
So you have it all here. So. If you're in this part of the diagram, neutrinos are not able to provide you with efficient cooling. So here, you basically have a thin disk. Well, here, you tend to have a thin disk. But as I will show you, really, in this case, neutrinos are not completely efficient at really getting rid of all the internal energy. And then there's a very nice transition, which is at radius that are far away from the black hole, the temperature is small, so alpha particles are allowed to exist. While if you go deeper into the accretion disk, you basically photodisintegrate the alpha particles into free neutrons and protons. And it's these free neutrons and protons that give you the main cooling mechanisms of with the neutrinos in the electroweak interactions. Now, since the matter is very neutron-rich, what are the electrons that you're going to see the most? Electron-active neutrinos. Not only that, because you're full of neutrons, neutrinos actually get absorbed by neutrons. Yeah. So, as I will show you, if you make an image of this, neutrinos, antineutrinos are not only producing more copiously, but they're absorbed less. So there is a discrepancy between your electron and neutrinos and antineutrinos. Okay. So just to, I don't know, you probably all know this, but so we, particularly Luis and I, are very interested in trying to understand whether these type of system would ultimately give rise to the gamma ray burst. Yeah. So the argument here is that you have two neutron stars orbiting around each other. If they're separated less than a stellar radius, like the sun radius, they will merge in less than a Hubble time. These, of course, are the prominent LIGO sources, but they go from their secular decay of the, you know, driven by gravitational waves to become dynamically unstable and merge within a few dynamical times. And just to give you a feeling of when this happens, so I thought just do the simplest possible thing. So we don't know what the equation of state of these neutron stars are. So I'm just assuming a polytropic, simple polytropic equation of state. When gamma is large, that means that the equation of state is incompressible, yeah? Because the small changes in density will lead to very large extent, you know, pressure variations. And this is the profile of the star that you build. It's almost constant density and then it decreases. Why? Because I can really compress. Yeah? So I get almost constant density stars. If I use a soft equation of state, I get neutron stars that are very highly centrally dense. Yeah? And then you ask, when does the instability, what is the onset of the instability? Well, that depends on the tidal forces. So what I'm showing here is actually the angular momentum per unit mass distribution. So for point masses, of course, it just follows a simple Kepler. But for 5/3, you have a minimum here. That means that basically once these stars become, the separation between them is about 3, they become dynamically unstable. The tidal perturbations, yeah, if you want delta r over r, get to be comparable to the size of the object. Yeah? You get a quadrupole distortion if you want, because amplitude is a order unit, and they become dynamically unstable. If you have a very non-compressible equation of state, this happens at larger distance. Why? Because you, of course, have much more mass at larger radius. Yeah. So tidal effects are certainly much more prominent at creating distortions in the star. Yeah? Okay, so naively you will think, when if the stars become dynamically unstable here and they collab, yeah, the ultimate temperatures that you reach are higher than in this case. Yeah. They're almost like free falling against each other, which is determining all these thermodynamical conditions. So these are the ones that we use. So we use a relativistic mean field theory for the equations of star of equations of states of neutron stars. And these are, you know, the profiles that we build. This is the effective gamma. So the effective gamma is actually close to 3. All the ways of the stars that we build are not very centrally condensed. This is their distribution. Well, this is YE, which is the neutron to proton fraction. In the absence of pairs, it's the electron to proton fraction. Yeah. So these objects are very, very neutron rich. You know, in the theory, of course, the YE is about 0.1. And I'm just going to show you a simulation. So, in contrast to what Luis does, here we really care about the microphysics. So we have put a lot of our energy in trying to get the microphysics right. And we basically put GR, you know, on hold. And we're basically doing a post-Newtonian way. And I just wanted to, just to give you a feeling that everything that I told you makes a lot of sense. So they're about to become dynamically stable. They do. They merge. In this case, the binaries are tidally locked. You get mass shredding in the atom Lagrangian points, where you eject about 10 to the minus 3 solar masses. We believe that that may be a nice primary site for our process nucleosynthesis. And as you can see, this is a clock. Yeah? So very few dynamical timescales. So we're following the composition and the cooling of these systems. And at some point, we stop the simulations. Yeah? And we stop the simulations basically when the diffusion timescale, because we're not doing full Boltzmann transport, when the diffusion timescale of the neutrinos becomes important. Yeah. And of course, since we don't have GR, in this case, if you want to think about it this way, the escape velocity of this central object is about 0.3c. So it's supported by differential rotation. But as Luis can tell you, there's lots of, especially GR, can drain the angular momentum of this very efficient.
So you just have like a neutrino gas or something.
Hmm?
When you say you don't have diffusion, you just have a neutrino gas, it's the fluid. Is that
the assumption? No, I mean, the only thing that I'm saying is that I'm not taking into account the momentum, the position of the... So we do diffusion, a simple diffusion scheme for the neutrinos to calculate the composition. But basically, when they start being important in injecting momentum, we should couple it to the hydro equations of state momentum. So we basically neglect the momentum of the neutrinos, which close to the eddy limit becomes important. Okay, so this is just to tell you that when the black hole is formed, the various groups that do this in GR and non-GR get a very different masses for the disks that are left around the black hole. So this is basically Newtonian and SPH, different methods, different post-Newtonian approximations, GR. And now it's believed that actually magnetic field amplification is crucial because magnetic field actually helps you to remove angular momentum and give you bigger disks. So there's a huge uncertainty in the community of what is the initial mass of the disk left, and that's why in some ways I thought it was nice to illustrate this, because when the disk is very thin, you may be in this regime. If you leave a very massive disk, you're in this regime, and you move as a function of time as you drain it.
What's SPH?
SPH is called smooth particle hydrodynamics, which is, the same method that I used before. So you basically divide your fluid into individual particles and calculate the forces, and it's a Lagrangian method. Which has, it's very good at actually at conserving angular momentum.
Grid means like an Eulerian.
That's right. Anyway, so for example, just to give you a feeling of our central object is about 2.5 solar masses. The densities are, nuclear density is 15 MeV, and even debris is like 0.2 solar masses, 10 to the 12, and 3 MeVs. In this case, it hasn't collapsed to a black hole, but what we use is we take the Western capture reactions, pair annihilation, and plasma decay. Plasma decay tends to be very important, just at very high densities, and of course give you other neutrino flavors. Well, these guys give you mainly neutrinos and antineutrinos. These are how the spectrum looks like, and that was just what I illustrated what I was telling you. The electron antineutrinos, because they're produced by neutrons in capture of the positrons, they're very prominent, while the electron neutrinos are not. So this is basically as a function of time, what are the luminosity, and the spectrum. And of course, the other flavor neutrinos are higher energies, because they have higher permeability. You have to worry, again, as we were saying, just about the opacity, and here, scattering of nucleons is important, but coherent neutrino nuclear scattering is actually very important because the cross section goes as a square. And then basically the inverse of the lepton reactions are also important.
Sorry, I don't understand. So you're saying you're not doing gradient transfer of neutrinos?
No, but we're doing the diffusion. So basically, the way that you should think about this is we do the diffusion, and when the diffusion time scale is comparable to the size of the object where the neutrinos are basically going to leave with the positive momentum, we stop resuming.
You stop your simulation, but I don't know. So to get the luminosity, you want to see how many neutrinos are coming out on the surface. That's where optical depths become formed, right?
So we can do that. We can do that in an e to the minus tau approximation in the diffusion case. But I mean, you can do this fairly simple without. But I mean, you have to be worried that you have in your hydro equations, you have to take the momentum, the position of the neutrinos, and that's what becomes problematic. But I can, offline if you want, I can show you some of the first attempts into doing this.
So are you saying that the chemical composition is very important here?
Yeah.
Because it's coherent neutrino.
Yeah. So this is just how the neutrino spheres, say before the collapses, that Luis calculates. So the neutrinos, the anti-electron neutrinos, they're produced more copiously and they're absorbed less efficient because they're absorbed by protons. The photospheres, this is basically where, you know, the scale in which the neutrinos decouple from the matter is here, while the electron neutrinos actually, you know, are much more deeper. They're producing less numbers than they're absorbed. Now, for example, very interesting things happen. The fact that these two photospheres are different means that these objects are actually convectively unstable. Yeah? So convection is an important component. So when you take into account the microphysics, not only you may have turbulence driven by, say, a differential rotation of the magnetic field, but also by convection. And we see this object be, you know, convectively unstable. So this is, for example, if you were to take a snapshot of neutrinos, you know, you even see the tidal features, which are hot. So the neutrinos in the core are opaque, so you don't see them, and most of the luminosity comes from the top. If you were, you know, we of course don't have the sensitivity of the neutrinos to actually even see these objects because they are so rare. We have to prove a volume, but it's very hot. Okay, so this is, for example, just to annoy Luis, a calculation by Stuart Shapiro's group that, you know, in which they put GR. You immediately see that this is an O'Leary calculation as opposed to an SPH calculation because they need this flood of background, and you see this artificial heating that the two neutron stars goes around, and then they have some prescription of when the black hole forms, and then what I call an accretion disk is everything that is left after the black hole. And these calculations look very, very different depending on which group you see and whether or not you have magnetic fields. Okay, so the calculations just simply, and I'll stop and I'll show you. We've been doing some GR MHD calculations. So we start with a torus of a given mass in hydrostatic equilibrium, and we evolve it as a function of time in a fixed metric.
Is it a thick torus?
Initially, it's a thick torus. And I'll show you what cooling does. And of course, these are calculations. Mainly, completely driven by Scott Novel. But when you have, this is an uncooled disk, and this is a neutrino cooled disk. And of course, we were very smart because we chose our initial conditions to be here. Yeah? So we chose our initial conditions in one, neutrino gives you some cooling, but we don't have to worry about the neutrino transport. Yeah? And the neutrinos are optically thin, so that means that as soon as they cool, they leave the remnant. And this is more or less, you know, the difference that neutrino make. So as you can see, yeah, neutrinos basically change the pressure scale high. This is tensile. But h over r is still, in our case, is about 0.3. So neutrinos are not extremely efficient to give you a very thin disk. And this is how it works. And you have to make sure that you're resolving the scale in which, you know, the magnetic rotation and stability is taking. This is basically what's driving the turbulence. And as you can see, you know, this object is draining as a function of time, but we can do that rather stably for many, many orbital timescales. Why? Because as I was telling you, the duration of a gamma ray burst is much longer than the dynamical timescale, so you really have to get into solutions that are, you know, close to steady.
So this is a relativistic simulation, but the metric is fixed around.
Yeah. So then you can tell me, oh, why did you take the metric thick? And I said, well, because I made sure that my disk was very small compared to the mass of the central object, and then I'm comfortable. If the disk starts to be higher and the black hole changes, then things become. So this is sort of idealized simulation with, you know, the right microphysics. And of course, we have chosen a disk that is what it's seen in simulations more or less, but I just wanted to emphasize that the simulations change in the disk that they get by 2 or 3 orders of magnitude. So if you're here, you're pretty doomed because you have to do self-gravity well, you have to do full Boltzmann transport, yeah, because the neutrinos are trapped in the interior, yeah, and you have to do an evolving metric.
But are those the small disks and low mass disks consistent with observation of gamma ray bursts?
So observation of gamma ray bursts tells you,
a
total energy, if you want, no, and a total m dot, and the, you know, the question is, you go back to this problem, no, you have some sort of accretion luminosity, and what you see is radiation, so you don't know with which efficiency. So the way that this works,
but you had you didn't have photon emission, you had just neutrino luminosity.
Let me rephrase my question.
Yeah.
If we are able to detect the neutrinos, then I can give you a perfect answer. But what is happening? So in a gamma ray burst, you have an accretion disk. It forms. I'll stop here. I think I've taken too much time. I will talk about pointing flux, but this is basically what I was just saying. So, if you really want to understand these sources, you really want to understand the metabolic pathways through which gravity, spin, and energy can combine to form collimated ultra-relativistic outflows. Because what I didn't tell you is that, you know, you have to have your first energy reservoir is gravity, gravitational binding energy. Gravity goes inwards, thus accretion. Then somehow this object has to produce a relativistic jet. Yeah? The relativistic jet dissipates its energy by some mechanism, which we can talk about it, produces, you know, goes from kinetic energy into radiation of the photons. Yeah? And that's what you see in your prompt gamma ray burst. So as you know, you're missing a step so that observationally you can determine from first principles what this, you know, ultimate energy reservoir it is, and if that stage is inefficient or not. But there are constraints on this. And the key, I think, which we all struggle to model, is that the interesting thing in gamma ray bursts is that most of the energy is carried by Lorentz factors that move at, you know, that are above 100. So your engine doesn't only have to convert gravitational binding energy, but it has to separate mass and energy very efficiently. Yeah? Remember, if you dissipate the energy where most of your binding energy is, like in the sun, you thermalize. Yeah? The sun is perfect conversion of binding energy in the core. It's emitted by photons, it thermalizes. Yeah? So it basically is shared by a huge number of particles. So that's why we rely on magnetic fields. So you want basically gravity, it's going worse. Viscosity, trivial viscosity generated this, the magnetic field self-consistently. Buoyantly, the field, you know, goes up, yeah, and somehow forms a collimated, highly relativistic outflow. And once you do that, then you can solve, you know, the problem of the gamma ray burst. But I just wanted to give you a feeling of this regime, which is basically something that, for example, the two communities, the GR community and the GRB community, want to come together to be able to, you know, simulate this problem self-consistently. I mean, the GR community, because these problems are complex and take time, usually use polytropes. Yeah? We usually use Newtonian calculations and we try to put this self-consistently. I'll stop there. I think it was hard.
I hope I'm not mixing things now, but I thought that that Ice Cube was supposed to see neutrinos connected with these gamma ray bursts and didn't. Can you comment?
You can tell me why. Because the neutrinos that I'm talking about here are the thermal neutrinos.
These are MeV scales.
These are MeV scales. So in principle, when the source is moving relativistically, and you know you need a shock or some dissipative process, you can tell HD. Basically go from pointing flux to, you know, to some internal energy, or if it's highly dynamic, some shocks to internal energy. You generate a non-thermal distribution of electrons, and then those cool. And then the question is whether or not GRB sources accelerate not only electrons, but protons. And if you accelerate protons, and you have, say, proton-photon interactions or something like that. So those interactions can give you high-energy neutrinos. And the flux of those high-energy neutrinos specifically, and also because they're beams and they're easier to detect, you can see. But the thermal neutrinos, you don't see. The MeV neutrinos, you don't see. So, for example, just
right, but is the story now that Ice Cube did not see those non-thermal neutrinos, which they were expected to?
So if expected to see is kind of difficult to answer because you don't really know. So in this source, the big debate is whether or not you accelerate protons effectively or not, and whether the mode of dissipation is leptonic or hadronic. And there's a wide range of models and a wide range of allowed values. So I don't think, for example, the non-detection of neutrinos from Ice Cube really rules out that these sources could be responsible for most of the high energy cosmic rays. That's the open scope for that. So the non-detections are not that stringent. So, for example, the only neutrinos that we're seeing, thermal neutrinos, are from 87A, which was very close. Since these objects happen so frequently, the amount of volume that you have to prove to see one of this is much larger, so they happen, you know, much, much farther away. And there's no way that we will see the thermal, at least for a while, to see the thermal, which it will be gray. So all of the inference from the source of what we think these objects are, you know, do not come. I mean, if we see gravitational waves, then you really know what the progenitor systems are. In this case, we have to rely on sort of other signatures to try to infer what the progenitor is. But there's no direct, you're not observing the engine, you're observing the reprocesses of kinetic energy at, you know, at scales that are maybe eight orders of magnitude far away from where the engine was, you know, generating these bombs.
I just have to wait for you.
So maybe this is something everybody knows, I'm embarrassing myself. Does that mean that the neutrino observatories, I guess you should only expect to see the neutrinos from GRBs that we can also see the gamma rays?
That's right. That are being, yeah, total flux. Yeah, the flux, you know, if you're away from the jet, decrease just so dramatically that you don't see. Once you're twice the opening angle of the jet, it's almost like 6-7 orders of magnitude of flux.
Same for neutrinos.
Well, for anything that it's, yeah, being told you, either the gamma rays or the... We only see GRBs that are not pointing towards us when they become close to non-relativistic, so they become much more spherically symmetric. Because then there's no beam. So for example, there's a huge effort in the community to monitor supernova of, you know, that are nearby, to see whether after a month or something like that, the radio emission just goes up. Because what happened, you had a GRB that was off center, and then slowly spans, becomes, you know, non-relativistic, and then starts, you know, contributing to emission that was away from the observer. But only at those wavelengths you expect to see GRBs that are not pointing towards you. Actually, in fact, I think CMB experiments may be an interesting probe for this, because they, you know, they see the sky almost, you know, they see the whole sky almost every day. So if you see a transit, you may be, I haven't done the calculation, but you may see these GRBs of axes. Yeah, an all sky radio survey may be the best to see these non pointing totals.
What are the ideas for producing these jets?
Well, I can show you some simulations. So what people that do these global MHD models see is that in the accretion disk, they see a turbulent field that is actually self-consistently amplified by the instability. Then they see some more coherent field, and one you go off axis, they see, you know, along the axis, they see, you know, a sort of directed pointing flux out. So the argument is that, you know, the GRB is happening in this direction when you make a coherent flow. You know, there's huge amounts of problems as to whether or not these type of magnetic field configurations are stable and, you know, can stay collimated for long time scales. But basically, people believe that if you have a magnetic field, you know, if you have a vertical component of the field and you have differential rotation, then you tend to wind up the field and get a pointing flux outflow. But, you know, these models have to predict that the majority of the energy comes into this collimated component. It's not entirely clear. And there's huge amounts of issues about numerically how you can handle flows in which the magnetic field becomes dominant compared to the rest mass of the baryons. Yeah, so numerically, as you know, those, I mean, people do force-free calculations of things, but in the MHD case, it's very difficult to handle very large signals where the pointing flux is very high.
So what was assumed in these simulations that you're showing?
In our case?
This is when you did these pictures?
No, so this is for people that do global MHD models, and this is actually very similar to what multiple groups are getting. So what people usually do in these calculations, they use an adiabatic equation of state. They have an initial seed field. The initial seed field basically grows the field self-consistently. They have a turbulent field, and these are the basically steady-state three-dimensional solutions that people get.
So there's no axis, you're not assuming any axis?
No. So this is... And fixed metric. In which which the mass of the disk is much smaller than the mass of the black hole. I think we have evidence that accreting black holes produce collimated outflows, but for people, for example, don't understand why AGN, which are supermassive black holes, produce maybe Lorentz factors that are a few, or blazars that are 10, and gamma ray bursts produce Lorentz factors that are 100, and microquasars also, Lorentz factors that are a few. If they're all kind of similar configuration, which is an accreting black hole. So whether or not these microphysics that we talk about are ultimately very important in determining the outcome, people don't understand. And of course, numerically doing thin disks, disks that cool very efficiently, is very difficult because they become geometrically thin, and you have to resolve the scale in which the instability takes place, and at the same time you have to resolve globally what's happening to the disk. So usually these calculations never take into account cooling. Yeah? They're done, if you want, in dimensionless units, yeah? In which basically they don't care about what the density and temperature is in absolute units, so they don't have cooling functions. And they also don't have radiation being important. In some cases, they're starting to put some flux limit diffusion. So yeah, I think we are very much in the early stages. People have qualitative pictures of how these may take place.
And they can be totally wrong.
What?
And they can be totally wrong. They include no cells.
Any other questions?
No, thanks. Thanks, Rick, again.